Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back Sheikh Hassan Spiker. You're most welcome, sir.
Lovely to see you again, Paul.
Lovely to see you. You're in Jordan today, I think, aren't you? You're now based there.
I am indeed. I'm back home in Jordan.
Wonderful. And I'm back home in London, actually, having just arrived here as well. For those who don't know, Hassan Spiker is a philosopher and second-generation Anglo-American Muslim. He spent 12 years studying the Islamic intellectual sciences in the Muslim world, primarily under the guidance of the Iraqi sage al-Sayyid Qusay Abus al-Sid. Sorry to butcher that. Could you pronounce that correctly?
It's actually difficult even for Arabs. It's As-Sayyid Qusay Abus Sa'd.
Perfect. Thank you. I'm glad you said that. He subsequently obtained his degrees in philosophy and philosophical theology from the universities of London and Cambridge, where he is also currently completing his doctorate. Now, he is the author of the following books, Things As They Are. I've got a copy of it there. Nafs al-Amr, The Metaphysical Foundations of Objective Truth. A very good book. And this one of my favorites, the Metacritic of Kant and the Possibility of Metaphysics. And that was in 2022 that was published. And most recently, Hierarchy and Freedom, an examination of some classical metaphysical and post-Enlightenment accounts of human autonomy. This is a really excellent book as well. His next book, yes, there are more, Transgenderism and the Assault on Human Nature, Navigating Modernity's Endgame, is forthcoming. Now, today, Hassan has kindly agreed to discuss his new article titled Transgenderism and the Violation of Our Angelic Nature. It's an extraordinary title. Published in the new edition of Renovatio, the Journal of Zaytuna College, a Muslim liberal arts college in California. And I have my, this is the current journal edition, and Hassan Spiker, you can see his name there. The article appears in this, and we both have our own copies, hot off the press. And I'm going to link, by the way, not only to the journal below, but also to the article from the journal, which you can read for free. And little plug for this extraordinary journal, by the way, the current edition has some amazing articles. For example, one of them, The Untold Stories of Enslaved African Muslim Women in the Americas. The Untold Stories of Enslaved African Muslim Women in the Americas, an extraordinary account of this. A lot of this history has been airbrushed away. It's been recovered now. Another one one of my favorites as well, What Walking Can Do for Our Souls. I love walking. What Walking Can Do for Our Souls, what a fabulous title. So I'll link to this as well, where you can get your own copy. Now, in the article Hassan's going to be talking about today, he provides, I think, a truly devastating philosophical critique of certain ubiquitous materialist ideologies that demand a radical rethink of traditional concepts about gender, sexuality, and the family, and how Hassan sees these as premised on the assumption of a godless universe. And he critiques in this article such seminal thinkers as Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, and Judith Butler, and notes the egregious impact their thought is having on our society, and calls on us to what he calls, quote, the healing and liberating truth offered by the tools of the Islamic tradition, end quote. So, over to you, sir.
Jazakumullah khairan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli wa sallim wa barik ala Sayyidina Muhammad. Wonderful. So transgenderism and the assault on human nature, which is the title, in fact, of the forthcoming book. So I'll set out straight with this quotation from John Stuart Mill. He says that theoretical philosophy, which to superficial people appears so remote from the business of life and the outward interests of men, is in reality the thing on earth that most influences them and in the long run outweighs every other influence.
Wow.
I just want to highlight this quote because the approach I'm taking in this presentation, in the article and in the book, inshallah ta'ala, is a little bit different from what may be familiar from the gender on discourse, the very voluminous discourse on gender. Did I just say gender on discourse? Discourse on gender and transgenderism that is currently flooding the internet and academic publications and so on, newspaper articles, because those treatments and the discourse tends to be very, very highly charged in a political sense. It's really an argument between left and right. It's an argument between the liberal and the conservative, between Democrat and Republican. I always like the saying, I think it's very apt, that the conservative person is that person that thinks and acts in exactly the same way as the liberal, just slower. And this is the problem. It's the kind of impasse of the contemporary discourse. It's very tribal. It's, well, I'm going to be on this team, you're on that team. Why? Well, neither side is able to provide very good reasons. It's really moralizing fundamentally, and political partisanship. And that can really only take you so far. I think the way to break the impasse is to realize that the claims made by transgender ideologues and proponents of gender fluidism are truth claims. They're either true or false. And they actually rest upon a very long philosophical genealogy and pedigree of really quite linear influence between key thinkers in the emergent modernity.
Yeah.
And so this is the hope with the work that I'm carrying out on transgenderism, that it will empower Muslims and other interested people to really come to their own conclusions about this extraordinary new phenomenon based on the real philosophical arguments that underpin them. And as Mill's saying here, you know, we dismiss philosophy at our own peril, because we will be influenced by philosophy, by that trickle down, whether we know it or not. But we can either have someone else doing our metaphysics for us, blithely unaware of what's going on, or we can participate in the conversation ourselves. So the first phenomenon I'd like to discuss here, which I think is really, really integral, is the transferal of the attributes of divinity to the free, self-determining, individual knowing subject. The transferal of the attributes of divinity to human beings as being one of the fundamental philosophical drivers of what's going on today. And it sounds like hyperbole, sounds like exaggeration. It's really not. This is precisely what's going on. And inshallah, in what follows in this section, we'll substantiate that and see exactly how that works.
Yeah.
So just to illustrate this principle, there's a little quotation from the article. So transgenderism, which I'm calling the central sacrament of the religion of dying postmodernity, and I ask the question, why is opposition to gender fluidism singled out for such focused, violent, and vituperative attack rather than other possible obstacles to radical free self-determination in defiance of authority, such as opposition to, say, incest or euthanasia?
Yeah.
Why is the doctrine of the plasticity, fluidity, and instability of gender imposed with so fervent and anxious a frenzy worthy of the Inquisition? It is because the act of sacred transmogrification constitutes the supreme rite and indeed sacrifice of the religion of dying postmodernity. A religion that represents the dramatic finale and death throes, the veritable Götterdämmerung, I think that's the first time I've ever said that, of the Western intellectual tradition itself, you know, the twilight of the gods.
I had to look that up, because Götterdämmerung from Wagner's opera, isn't it, The Ring? It means the twilight of the gods, the death of the gods, basically, in German. It's a German word, obviously. Yep.
It's the twilight of the gods of the Western intellectual tradition itself.
Yeah.
Reverence for the communicant that is the post-operative transitioner, and celebration of his, her, their sacrifice, for they died to their dead names for the sake of our freedom, becomes a quasi-theurgical sacrament, a sign by which one's self-creation might alone be worshipped, such that one's true status as unrestrictedly, ontologically free becomes finally revealed before our very eyes as sole and unquestionable absolute reality.
Wow. So you're really just, I mean, it's very, very clear here and explicit. You're characterizing this phenomenon as a religion with all of the rites and the ideologies and the talk about the communicant and reverence and new creation is very Christian in a way, isn't it? The sacrifice. It's a paganism, it's like Christian overtones there, but it has all the fervor and the encompassing worldview of a religion in its metaphysics. Extraordinary.
Exactly, and that's a good point you make, because it comes directly out and only out of a post-Christian milieu.
Mm.
And I think that's very significant.
Yeah.
So this is one of these key figures here, yes. Ludwig Feuerbach. I mean, this is one of these philosophers who kind of lurks in the background.
Yes.
He's hugely influential on Nietzsche.
Marx.
Hugely influential on Marx, of course, and hugely influential on Freud.
Yeah.
In his notion of projection, which we're about to discuss.
I've never seen a photograph. I didn't know there was a photograph of the guy, because he was, this is like early 19th century, but it's a photograph. It's the first time I've ever seen one of him. But anyway, all these years.
I think there might be a couple of others, although I can't tell whether they're photographs or paintings. But this one definitely seems to be a photograph.
Yeah, it's a photograph. Cool. Never seen that. Yes.
So this is his essence of Christianity, his very, very famous book.
Yes.
In which he advances his immensely controversial thesis, it must have been in I think the 1840s, which is that rather than, when I wrote the bill, it's an awful, awful thing to say, rather than God having created man in his own image, it's actually the reverse. It's man, when I wrote the bill, who's created God in his own image.
Well, can I just go back to that? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just can't resist the opportunity to note, translated from the second German edition by Mary Ann Evans, who, of course, is better known as George Eliot. George Eliot.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah. She used to translate extraordinary radical German biblical scholarship and radical German theology like Feuerbach. But she actually became famous in Victorian England as the author of Middlemarch and Milhelm of Floss and all these amazing books. But Middlemarch, this book by her, because she was actually not a man. She published as George Eliot, but obviously she was a woman. But because of the, you know, the prejudice of the day, she decided to have a man's name. But George Eliot's book, Middlemarch, is usually seen as the greatest novel ever written in English. In the English language, in English literature, is that important? But she had this sideline, and she herself, by the way, was an atheist. She had read this stuff, become radicalized by it. She'd read Feuerbach, she'd read Nietzsche, and so on. She became radicalized, and it caused a bit of a scandal in Victorian England that she was known not to believe in Christianity. Anyway, that's another subject. I couldn't let it pass. Mary Ann Evans, one of the greatest novelists in English literature in history, also translated this egregious text.
Absolutely. And she was, there's a very sad story of her unrequited love for Herbert Spencer, and she was very much mixing in those radical anti-religious circles.
Yes, absolutely. Sorry, but I just, thank you.
So this is a quotation directly from The Essence of Christianity.
Yeah,
I was looking over it recently, trying to extract the kind of pith of it, and I think these two really do it, hopefully. So he says, the divine being is nothing else than the human being, or rather the human nature purified, freed from the limits of the individual man, made objective. So we're falsely objectifying, we're maximizing our human attributes, and we're falsely reifying it in an external being called God. This is what Feuerbach is teaching us.
Yeah. Yes.
i.e. contemplated and revered as another, a distinct being. All of the attributes of the divine nature are, therefore, attributes of the human nature. Man, this is the mystery of religion, projects his being into objectivity, makes it into an object, So the subject makes himself into an object, and then again makes himself an object to this projected image of himself, thus converted into a subject. So he makes himself an object, as it were, looking through God's eyes that he's just created. He thinks of himself in an object, is an object to himself, but as the object of an object, of another being than himself. So we're jumping now to a statement of the fundamental change, which is really crowned by postmodernism. We'll fill in lots of the gaps as we proceed with different sections of the discussion. But this is a kind of summation of the influence, the end result, the logical end of the principles that we've just seen expounded by Feuerbach. And it will give an indication of just how influential Feuerbach has been, and just how the extent to which, via Nietzsche, via Freud, and via Marx, his views have actually shaped the intellectual establishment.
Yeah.
So this is from a book, Deconstruction in Context, is actually the introduction. And he said, I remember encountering this once in the UL in the Cambridge University Library years ago and being really, really struck by it. So he says, in the wake of Descartes' Meditations, modern philosophy becomes a philosophy of the subject. This is one of the first steps. The locus of certainty and truth. Subjectivity is the first principle from which everything arises and to which all must be reduced or returned. With the movement from Descartes through the Enlightenment to idealism and romanticism, attributes traditionally predicated of a divine subject are gradually transferred to the human subject. Through a dialectical reversal, when over the beloved, the creator God dies and is resurrected as the creative subject. As God created the world through the Logos, so man creates a world through conscious and unconscious projection. In different terms, the modern subject defines itself by its constructive activity.
I mean, I'm sorry, just to protest slightly here. When I studied Descartes University, his Meditations, I was very struck how you're aware this the centering on the subject, the cogito, I think, therefore I am. That became the certainty in Descartes' epistemology. What he couldn't doubt that he was doubting. But he then went on, and this was missing from the course, and I knew it was missing because I'd read the Meditations before I went to university, is the ontological argument, where he sought to reestablish the truth of God's existence, the creator God's existence, through pure reason, and thereby guaranteeing the efficacy and reliability of our sense perceptions of the world, which he had called into doubt through methodological skepticism. But my point is that Descartes himself wasn't an atheist. He was theocentric ultimately in his concerns, but they've been lopped away. It's been kind of minimalized or ignored in the subsequent philosophical tradition, I discovered. So he's been misrepresented to some extent by ignoring the theocentric aspects of his philosophy. So what you're reading there is true, but I'm protesting that Descartes has been strong-armed through this to be made out to be something he really wasn't. He didn't believe.
Quite right.
I think it's unfair on Descartes. For him, the supreme subject was God, but his epistemology, in the way he did it, centered on the subject, the I, the ego, the ego. I think, therefore, I am, and thus that's why he is used that way by people.
Absolutely, and I totally agree with you. And Descartes is a brilliant philosopher. People focus in on the Meditations, but he considered his most important book to be Principles of Philosophy, which was a metaphysical and physics textbook. And absolutely, as you say, we associate him with methodological skepticism, but he wasn't a skeptic at all. The methodological procedure was simply to affirm absolute certainty, to find that absolutely certain.
So God himself guaranteed the reliability, because God is good and he wouldn't deceive us. And therefore, the way we perceive the world is actually reliable. And that was the fundamental epistemological foundation of his worldview. But you wouldn't kind of know that reading that paragraph, although what the paragraph says is true. There's a way Descartes has been used in a truncated form for this movement that you're describing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's the way he's being used. And I think it's a consequence, really, of what they call the Cartesian split.
Yeah.
And so it's this idea that there's a radical bifurcation between subjectivity and objectivity. Mm. And what's out there in the world is just extended substance, is just mathematically analyzable body. And therefore, it almost drives a wedge between man's subjective appraisal of the contents of his own mind and exploring that subjectivity and this kind of hypostatized external world, which is just extended, it's just mechanical, brittle kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think, yes, that's the way that he can be misused and has been misused.
I think he has. Thank you very much for tolerating that.
No, it's very enriching. Please continue to interject and enlighten us.
You're very kind.
So we're going to go through various different stages and sections in order to try to get to grips with these metaphysical foundations. But I think before we proceed any further in that, it's just probably a good idea to recap and summarize basically our present situation.
Mm.
The dominant mainstream views, which are now being really enforced, frankly, as I think we're all becoming increasingly aware, on really the normativity of gender fluidism. So the inversion of sex and sexuality. So my contention here is that the place that we've arrived now, which is the denial of sex in the sense of gender, and as we'll discuss, there's no real distinction. But there are stages. How did we get here? There are stages by which we arrived at this very odd point, which seems so unintuitive, but nonetheless, something about the underlying logic, the false logic of it, is appealing to people. So how do we get here? So, you know, the West in the last 60 years now, really, it's since the 1960s, and the so-called sexual revolution has progressed, it's developed towards this point. And what's kind of surprising about the transgenderism movement is how quickly that suddenly accelerated, really, within the last 10 years. But there's really a very logical sequence here. So it starts out with the normalization of heterosexual promiscuity, which we find in the 1960s, you know, the hippie movement, free love, and so on. The UK led the way, you know, free provision of contraceptives on the NHS, laws to do with abortion, laws to do with censorship. And so this entails the rejection of the category of sin. If we're normalizing heterosexual promiscuity, then we've thereby rejected the concept of zina. That means there's no such thing as zina.
Yeah.
One is free to choose one's sexual partner. And we're talking about ordinary, normal sexual proclivities at the moment, normative sexual proclivities. Mm-hmm. So even within that realm, there's no such thing as sin.
Yeah, it used to be called when a man and a woman who were not married lived together, it used to be called living in sin. And this is very common. And this is a criticism, and not meant ironically. This was a serious kind of moral criticism of, my God, they're living in sin. And that actually existed. I remember even as a child hearing this expression. It's completely disappeared now from any discourse I've heard.
Yeah. I think children growing up in the West, you know, it's this race, as you know, for people to lose their virginity in secondary schools. It, you know, 13, 14, 15, they're becoming used to promiscuity. It's cool to sleep around, to have sex with as many people as possible. And it is this race for young people, and very few people are accepted. And those who are usually feel very left out. Unfortunately, that's our present reality. When I was 14 in year 8 in a very normal school in Cambridge, a girl got pregnant at the age of 14 and had to leave the school. And, you know, that was in the 90s. And things have advanced, if you want to call it advancement, a great deal since then. But the point is, how do we move from the normalization of promiscuity to the denial of heterosexual normativity? Well, it's exactly in this idea of the rejection of the category of sin. Because you then think, well, if there's no such thing as sin, surely I should be free to extend my desire to whatever I feel like. There's no sin anyway. So if promiscuity is acceptable and it has nothing to do with the heterosexual premise of that promiscuity, but it's rather than just the free exercise, really the arbitrary exercise of one's sexual desire, then why not extend it to something else? Because it's simply another object of desire. One can desire whatever one wants, part of one's freedom. So the moral neutrality of the extension of desire to other forms of promiscuity, it's all simply a matter of choice. So the next phrase is the next stage is the denial of heterosexual normativity. And this is something that Foucault, as we'll see, was very, very big on. And in fact, let's go to this little quotation at the bottom, which is from Judith Butler's very, very important book, Gender Trouble. She says, Wittig concurs, Monique Wittig, however paradoxically with Foucault, in claiming that the category of sex, as in gender, would itself disappear and indeed dissipate through the disruption and displacement of heterosexual hegemony. So,
wow.
How does this work? Right. And of course, we're not saying it really works in reality. We're saying one can glean a certain false logic that has led to the widespread sense of the plausibility of these changes. So why? It's because sexuality no longer presupposes an opposite gender, an opposite sex. So one is freely discharging one's desire, regardless of the object of desire. It doesn't matter. What matters is one's freedom and the fact that one has desire and wants to realize and fulfill that desire. So in sexual practice, in sexuality, in the free exercise of sexuality, I don't know if that's the best way to express it, but anyway, in the free exercise of sexuality, the integrity of the genders no longer plays a defining role. It's not relevant what happens to be the object of that desire. It's certainly not within a binary of male and female and an opposite gender. And the point is not that everyone has become a raging homosexual, but it is that it's the denial of heterosexual normativity which becomes widely accepted. And the point is the assent, the acceptance on a society-wide level that sexuality doesn't have to involve opposite genders. And so the role and importance of the genders becomes sidelined. It's simply one option amongst many. And so then we get to the denial of sex, gender itself. So sex, gender is itself a false reification of certain forms of sexuality. This is Foucault's famous theory. There's no such thing as sex or gender. There are only forms of sexuality. And then because of power interests, as in the need to populate the state and so to cultivate reproduction and so-called heterosexual normativity, we need to concretize falsely this notion of sex as being a real extramental essence, where it's not. What's really there are certain forms of sexuality, and then we falsely reify out that our notions of sex, of gender. And this comes, as we'll see later, from deep philosophical roots in Kant ultimately, but very specifically in Hegel and then in Marx, which is seeing reality and intelligibility, the objective knowability of the world, and the idea of essence, no longer is this timeless reality, whether it's a Platonic heaven or the knowledge of God, the timeless knowledge of God, but rather as a process, as an evolving process. And we'll go into that more.
Yeah, Hegel's big on that, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Hegel's the man. He's got a lot to answer for, Hegel. So in any case, moving on. So what we're going to explore further now is this question of how did we get here to this third stage here, which is denial of sex, which is now being propagated in schools, indeed in kindergartens and nursery.
Yes. Yes.
And is leading to this widespread adoption of self-identification, rather, of some some place on the LGBTQ plus spectrum by young people in extraordinary numbers. And I think they say that Generation Z, rather than about 4% in the rest of the population, about 20% now identify as LGBTQ. Now, they'll, of course, say that's because of the oppression of the false normativity of heterosexuality and the concrete reality of gender has now been lifted, and so people are now free to explore other options. And I think we would probably, and indefinitely, of course, suggest a very different interpretation of that, of that phenomenon. But in any case, we can discuss that more. So how did we get to this point? We got to this point in terms of ethical and political philosophies that need to be taken into consideration, and the metaphysical backdrop as well. Now, what I'm focused on here is really the metaphysical backdrop. The ethical and political really amounts to John Stuart Mill's harm principle, which is that no one has the right to interfere in someone's own free exercise of their self-determining will, except to for self-protection and to avoid harm. So everyone is free to do whatever they want to do as long as they're not causing any harm. And that is a principle that almost any person that you run into and start discussing these issues with, whether it's in England or America, they will, not to be rude, but they'll parrot this principle. There are very few who actually believe it based on, would be able to provide philosophical substantiation. But this principle is very intuitively correct. I mean, as long as you're not hurting anyone, you're free. Who are we to impose our lifestyle on you? And we shouldn't interfere. And that includes moral censure. We can't say that you're doing something objectively wrong. We can't say that this phenomenon and these beliefs, and whether it's active homosexuality or it's transitioning as a transgender person, are wrong or unnatural or not in accordance with nature, because that's to give a moral judgment. That's to treat these things in terms of a theory of the good. And everyone has their own theory of the good. And there's no way that we can impose one theory of the good on others. We're free to adopt our own theory of the good, but there are no objective theories of the good. So it's basically John Stuart Mill's harm principle, and it becomes further detailed and finds different applications in, let's say, Berlin's distinction between positive and negative liberty. I mean, these are things perhaps for another time or another speaker. And I think probably you've had someone on, you've had so many extraordinary meetings talking about these features of political liberalism. And then, of course, Rawls and his original state and all of that stuff. And it really goes back very quickly just to the kind of Lockean empiricist assumption that one can't root an objectivist ethical theory, moral objectivism, in one can't provide metaphysical foundations for any such theory on empiricism. Because on empiricism, ethical and moral properties are simply not empirical properties. And there's no way even in principle to root them. In any case, but what I'm focusing on here is the metaphysical backdrop. Now, one of these most important principles, again, is this idea that we've discussed earlier, that intelligibility in essence is as processes rather than instantiations, that rather it's the contention that intelligibility in essences are processes rather than instantiations of timeless objects of divine knowledge. Now, this is presupposed in one we've already seen, which is the transferal of the attributes of divinity to the free, self-determining individual knowing subject. So this, the one we're looking at now, is a later development. What it presupposes is this: intelligibility in essence is as processes rather than instantiations of timeless objects of divine knowledge. So one of the very, very key figures here is this rather majestic figure, dark figure, Karl Marx.
Indeed.
So let's have a look at what Marx says. So again, I mean, I think he's an extraordinary manifestation. This individual is a very, very extraordinary manifestation of what the corroboration of what the quotation that we saw from Mill at the beginning, which is people think that theoretical philosophy doesn't really matter. It's just a luxury that ivory tower intellectuals indulge in. Well, the ultimate figure who proves that wrong is Marx. I mean, look at how he yeah. he transformed the world on every level as the direct result of his philosophy. So in any case, so this is coming out of a section of the article. So we're talking about the rejection of essences, the rejection of the idea that beyond subjectivity, there is a real world which is distinct in itself, which has intrinsic real intelligibility, real knowability, real objective knowability. And in a way, to know the world is to receive with a passive, not a solely passive, but a passive dimension, to receive intelligibility from the world because it's actually there. Whereas what unites these various views which underpin transgender theory is the idea that there's no real world out there beyond the construction undertaken by each individual human being's subjectivity. So this reached its culmination perhaps in Jean-Paul Sartre's justification for the casting aside of human nature altogether, namely that existence precedes essence. Now we'll go into that in the next slide. But it was his spiritual master Marx, and he really was his spiritual master. I mean, Sartre had huge reverence for Marx. The spiritual master Marx, who had previously explained that religion is, quote, the fantastic realization of the human essence, exactly because, quote, the human essence has no true reality. Mm. For, quote, man is no abstract being squatting outside the world, and he's lampooning metaphysical theories of forms or whatever it happens to be.
Yes, so just, I mean, the language he uses there, the word squatting outside the world. When I come across squatting, is kind of a scatological metaphor.
Yeah.
And it implies a revolting, kind of debased activity. Yeah. It's not a neutral description, but the subtle influence of his language here in degrading a certain metaphysical perspective is extraordinary. He was a master of English or German. I don't know if you write in German or English here, but he was very clever in his use of language and the way it affects.
Master of rhetoric, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. He was it's something I wanted to point out. Marx is a master of rhetoric. We mustn't underestimate these figures. They're very, very dark figures, but we mustn't underestimate them. You know, I've just downloaded Marx's 55 volume collected works.
Wow.
I was trying to find the treatises where he really, which are real technical, theoretical, philosophical treatises. And I was really taken aback. He is an absolute master of philosophy. I mean, I found it very difficult to keep up. When he's outside of, I mean, he wrote for newspapers, he wrote for journals, he wrote lots in lots of different mediums. But when he's doing technical philosophy, he's actually very frightening.
He studied philosophy at the University of Berlin. He was a fan of Hegel, a young
absolutely.
Hegel.
And it's actually his exposition of Hegel that I'm particularly talking about.
Right. I mean, the young Marx was quite, the young Marx was very philosophical. But yeah, he was a trained philosopher.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's worth bearing that in mind. There's more to this than just the rhetoric, you know, the sigh of the oppressed soul and all of that, and the opium of the matter.
Yeah,
So he says the human essence has no reality, for man is no abstract being squatting outside the world. Man is the world of man, the state, society. So there's exactly this inversion. It's
When I first read this, as a teenager, I was seduced by this. Man is the world of man, the state. So I thought, I had an epiphany when I read that. Yeah, of course, he's right. And I became a Marxist by seduced by this language. Thank
absolutely.
God I'm not a Marxist. But it's a powerful effect on a naive, young, immature mind. Mine
it's
wasn't it?
Very seductive. And you know, when Marx wrote these words, its time had come.
Yes.
Because of the metaphysical backdrop of, yes, of Kant and Hegel and Feuerbach and so on,
yeah,
this made sense.
Yes.
It, yes, made sense. We didn't have access to some great traditional philosophy or something, and you were very much within the contemporary milieu. This made sense. This was getting at truth. So
that's right.
He says, for Marx, for Marx, there is no essential human nature. Instead, there are only, quote, historically specific forms of human nature. That is, human nature specific to feudalism, to capitalism, to socialism, and so on. And this, of course, is dialectical materialism, which is a dialectical process, which is an inversion of Hegel. We'll discuss
that. The Soviet attempt to create the new Soviet man, which was literally trying to create a new human nature. But on the basis of this, you have a human nature specific to feudalism, capitalism, etc., and then communism. But of course, it failed because you can't create these. Man is not plasticine like that. You can just mold de novo out of nothing. And so it failed and became a totalitarian state. Where you, anyway, I digress. But just
very important. That's what they found out. I mean, that's what it didn't work out for them because
it didn't work out.
Came up against reality.
Exactly. Sorry.
So he goes on. Indeed, the real nature of man is the totality of social relations.
Yes.
So it's this extraordinary inversion. It's hard to exaggerate how influential, as you said, this formulation has been.
Seductive.
It's what underlies Sartre. It's what underlies what we're going to see from Foucault. It is what underlies Butler. And it's the idea that we falsely concretize and reify these natures, these essences. Whereas all that is real is the world of flux, the world of becoming, the world of process, of change, and of what they call the dialectical process.
And evolution, because Karl Marx wanted to dedicate his great work, Das Kapital, to Charles Darwin, and actually wrote to him, apparently, and said, can I dedicate my great work, my magnum opus, to you? Darwin said no, thank goodness.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Thank goodness he said no. Can you imagine? But the point is, of course, that Dharma was about processes as well. So this was in the air. This was the zeitgeist. This is 19th century England, where Marx and Darwin both lived in London, of course. They were both in London at the same time. It was part of the zeitgeist. And thus, I think that's why it had a credibility and its time had come, as you put it.
Absolutely. And apparently when Darwin received The Origin of Species, he was absolutely delighted and thrilled and radiant. And he said, this is just my philosophy in the realm of biology.
Really? Yeah.
Apparently. So this is an extraordinary phenomenon, is this idea that reality, and as you say, becomes very, very widespread, and in people like Darwin and people like Herbert Spencer in so many different realms, that reality is fundamentally this flux. It's this material unfolding, this process. There are no real natures there. What is there is this struggle, this state of perpetual becoming and never being, as such, what we think are distinct timeless essences of human nature and the family and God and gender and so on are really constructions. They are human acts. They're human activities. So in any case, we'll see this in lots of in many of Marx's descendants. So the real nature of man is the totality of social relations. A consequence of Marx's views on human nature was that he likewise tended to view gender as a dynamic concept capable of further development. This is because since both nature and society are not static entities, there can be no trans-historical notion of what is natural. Instead, the concept of natural can only be relevant for specific historical circumstances. So I'm not going to go into Hegel very much, just very quickly, because I think it's really important to be aware that there's no Marx without Hegel, and there's no Feuerbach without Hegel. And sure, they will point out that they are refuting many aspects of Hegel and they're moving beyond Hegel and they're modifying Hegel's philosophy and they're even opposed to Hegel. But this is one of these things that one has to be very careful of. You know, sometimes people come up very proudly to, and you say, no, it's not, existentialism's not relevant anymore because it was replaced by structuralism, and then that was replaced by post-structuralism. And you know, sometimes people just want to show that they're very clever and they know lots of different philosophical terms. But the point is, there is no real difference between these. There is this common thread of intelligibility that you can pull all the way from Kant through Hegel, through Feuerbach, through Marx, into Sartre, into then Foucault, and then Butler and so on, and the really extreme postmodernists. So this is actually a kind of trick. We think, well, no, existentialism isn't relevant anymore. It's gone out of fashion, which it certainly has, having been the most fashionable thing in the universe in the 1960s. But the reality is there would be no Foucault and no Butler without Sartre. And there's no Sartre without Marx. And there's no Marx without Hegel. And, of course, Feuerbach. We mustn't forget Feuerbach. He's very important. So Hegel's basic theory is the following. His basic theory is what governs reality is this dialectical process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And this is what is really fundamental to reality, because it governs the real nature of reality, which is to be becoming. Reality is purely a developmental reality. It's a reality in flux, which changes and evolves very, very importantly. So he'll start with, for example, the notion of being, pure being, that God is absolute being. And he'll say, this is a thesis, but it contains a contradiction, right, which is the antithesis. It contains a contradiction, because the whole point of pure being is to be completely indeterminate, right? If you say, well, pure being means all of the determinate things, no, those are determinate things. So, you know, the computer in front of me, the divine name on the wall, the curtains, all of these are all determinate beings, they're determinate instances of being. So when we say our starting point in philosophy and the true nature of God is just pure being, which is outside of determination, it's outside of the world, he'll say, well, that's subject to the dialectical process, that contains a contradiction. Why? Because in order to understand being is, we have to understand pure being is, we have to understand its opposite, which is pure nothingness. So pure being is not pure nothingness. But pure being is the indeterminate. It's the completely indeterminate. Well, that's exactly what pure nothingness is. Pure nothingness is the completely indeterminate. So then, you know, we're trying to play host to these contradictory notions, and we make progress by going to the synthesis. The synthesis is, well, no, there's no such thing as pure being. All there is becoming, right? All there is becoming, which is determinate beings, not being itself. It's determinate beings existing in relation to one another, undergoing this temporal process together, right? So everything is in time, everything is temporal, everything is subject to time. But then there's a further stage, which is, well, determinate being, the notion of determinate being, also contains a contradiction. It's self-negating, right? It's this very, very Hegelian, it's self-negating. Determinate being is self-negating because it's only intelligible, it's only has reality by, in terms of being determinate, by being not other than itself. And I'm going to stop very soon, don't worry, for anyone who's getting a little bit lost. The determinate being contains its own negation, because what it means to be a determinate being is to not be other, than other determinate beings, right? So the very idea of determinacy has to invoke the idea of other determinate beings. And those other determinate beings are in this state of constant struggle and war against one another. All of these determinate beings, because they're finite, right, they are always pressing up against each other and basically locked in this struggle for survival. Because the determinate being can only exist in the conditions, right, of, the exactly right physical circumstances and conditions and variables which allow us to exist on Earth, for example. All of those factors, all of those variables are also themselves determinate beings, which have their own finitude and their own sense of dependency on everything else, right? So the point is, everything is negating itself ultimately and devouring itself just by being finite, because it's trying to self-actualize, and there's no way that it can fully self-actualize. We have a finite lifespan. We are subject to all of these environmental and personal and social constraints and limitations which press upon us. Everyone else also wants to get their piece of the pie, also wants to make their own way in the world. And so this constant struggle. And this is exactly the dialectical procedure. So there are no essences for Hegel in the set in the traditional sense, which is really universal to traditional civilizations, whether one is a Christian Thomist, or one is a traditional Platonist, or one is a, let's say, a Muslim Avicennan, or someone who adheres to various forms of Kalam, that in the intelligibility of the world, the reason that the world is objectively knowable and their real essences is because that intelligibility and those essences are not contained within the individual, within the determinate instance. Those are just merely instances. They presuppose that timelessly those essences exist. They are actually prior. The intelligibility of the world, the essences that make up the world,
yeah,
actually exist timelessly prior to their emergence in what we can call the realm of becoming.
And there's a debate about, because Hegel identified as a Christian, of course, in his day in 19th century Berlin, where he was a very esteemed professor of philosophy, of course. But what kind of Christian he was is debated. Was he a pantheist? Was he a panentheist? There's a distinction, of course. But he certainly wasn't, I don't think, in any way an Orthodox Christian in the Lutheran sense, let alone in the Thomist sense or anything like that, because of what you said, the Geist, the spirit, was very much immanent in the process of history itself. And what Marx famously did, he inverted Hegel's whole metaphysical structure, if you like, turned him on his head, as he put it. And that's another subject, from idealism to matter, material processes.
Exactly.
Anyway. That was very clear, Hassan. Thank you. Very interesting.
That's very kind of you, Paul. I found what you said much clearer, and I wish we'd just stuck with what you said.
It was only about 10 words, and it was yours.
Exactly. That's because you probably understand it much more than I do. But in any case, moving swiftly on, let's go to the if you don't mind, sir. Oh no, I can do it.
Indeed. That was a picture of Sartre there for a second. Okay. Yeah.
So we've done Marx. Marx is an inversion of Hegel. He keeps the centrality of the dialectical process in existence, but it becomes a purely material process. Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yes.
Marx student.
Indeed.
So we are proceeding along our journey towards understanding what's going on today in terms of transgenderism. And another very, very key figure is Jean-Paul Sartre.
Just want to mention, by the way, for those who don't know, he died in 1985. He was a Frenchman, a Jewish Frenchman, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature, of all things, but a very one of those great French intellectuals, incredibly famous in his day. There's still footage of his funeral, I think in 1985 in Paris. Hundreds of thousands of ordinary Parisians lining the streets, because in France, of course, philosophy is a popular subject amongst the general population, not just a ivory tower pursuit. So he was very famous as a political activist, as a dramatist, a playwright, and a philosopher, amongst many other things. Anyway, that was just to say who he was. He wasn't German, he was French.
Yeah, so it's the German and the French. It's those...
Is this existentialism and humanism? Oh, it is, yes.
It is, yeah. I was just going to say, let's not risk a British joke about the German-French. In any case, what do we mean by saying that existence precedes essence? So this is Sartre's very, very famous principle statement, which is very much associated with... in that book.
I just dug this out from my bookshelf. This is my old dirty copy of Existentialist Humanism when I was about 16. I read this, and briefly I became a disciple of Jean-Paul Sartre in my head. And again, like Marx, very seductive. I found him very seductive as a teenager anyway. Yeah. And this horrible old copy, which I've not touched since, and I will probably bin ultimately because I'm not going to read it again, having sucked the marrow out of it. And I know what he thinks, and I don't agree with it anymore. But
you could auction it, because that looks like
a couple of dollars. Yeah, won't even be worth that. But if you must read it, do read it. It is readable. It is important in terms of the genealogy of the situation we're in, the pedigree of the ideas, as you put it, of how we get to where we are, is to understand people who authored things like this published in the 1940s, just after the war, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is indeed from that very readable Existentialism and Humanism, which is not from Being and Nothingness, where he goes into this in more detail. It's much more readable. If you don't want to torture yourself by reading Being and Nothingness, I'd suggest Existentialism and Humanism is much shorter.
About 1% of the length, and Being and Nothing is about 4 inches thick.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's this famous principle that existence precedes essence. And you would have, 1960s students at their demonstrations, they would have been excitedly parroting this principle, probably having no idea what it meant. But in any case, we mean that man, first of all, exists, encounters himself, surges up in the world, and defines himself afterwards. It's very akin to the process from the concept of pure being in Hegel to finding that there's a tension there, and then we become determinate, right? So if man, as the existentialist sees him, is not definable, it is because to begin with he is nothing. So it's an extraordinary form of nihilism. Nothing.
It's also John Locke's blank slate, isn't it? That we have no human nature. We have no particular humanity. We are formless. We are nothing. And only in our being thrown into the world, to use Heidegger language, do we become something. Because it denies our, obviously Islamically, in terms of Abrahamic faith, it denies our created nature, our fitra. This is all hellish stuff, because it robs us of our birthright, is to be creatures of the creator. But and I don't anticipate what you're saying, but
no, yeah, it's great. And can I just say that it's a common mistake, I think, to believe that somehow there's this very, very stark difference, that just never the twain shall meet, completely different things, British empiricism and this continental style philosophy. It's not the case. There are a lot of empiricist assumptions even in this very different stream.
John Locke, this is pure. John Locke could have, well, anyway, it's another subject, but anyway, I'm not going to go there.
Okay, in that case, I'll go on reading. So he will not be anything until later, because he's just said to begin with, he is nothing.
Exactly.
He will not be anything until later. And then he will be what he makes of himself. So it's the construction of human nature in every case, and every individual is to construct their own human nature. Thus, there is no human nature, because there is no God to have a conception of it.
Because there is no God. It's denial of God is the heart of this.
Precisely. But what I find extraordinary about this is Sartre really did understand philosophy.
Exactly.
And he understands that he is rejecting that traditional metaphysical framework. He understands that if the essence of human nature doesn't exist timelessly, it doesn't really exist at all.
Exactly. And that's what Nietzsche understood that point before Sartre, of course. Yeah.
Absolutely. So he says, man simply is, not that he is simply what he conceives himself to be, but he is what he wills. Right. Mm. So this, again, this prioritization of the will, which is very characteristic of everything that we're discussing. And as he conceives himself after already existing, as he wills to be after that leap towards existence, man is nothing else but that which he makes of himself.
Exactly.
So then we go to his consort.
His partner. Yeah. Is that the right word? What is the right? I've never quite. I mean, they weren't actually married, were they? I don't think.
No, they weren't married, and they were early proponents of the open relationship. So
they were living in sin. Sorry, just to clear, they were living in sin then. We need to be clear on this.
They were living in sin, and they thought it was all right to allow. I mean, they didn't mind multiple partners in that. So they were early proponents of what now, of course, is called the open relationship, very famously. So anyway, his partner, I think that's right, Simone de Beauvoir. Now, she's very interesting because now she's the last step before we get to explicit transgender theory in Butler, right? So she builds and really presupposes, she modifies certain things, but that shouldn't blind us to the fact that they're fundamentally the same. She presupposes Sartre's philosophy and that of Marx and that of Feuerbach and that of Hegel and so on, with modifications. I'm not saying they in any way they wholesale adopt Hegel's philosophy. Of course they don't, but with you know, the continuity of certain key principles.
Yeah.
And her very, very important contribution to all of this is her distinction between sex and gender.
Yeah.
And so what you'll find today, so again, it's very much presupposing this kind of bifurcate, this, you know, this almost Cartesian split. You know, sex is anatomy and it's really very boring and it's just physical. It's just physical formations. And they're really neutral in terms of interpreting what they are. This is the whole point. Everything else is interpretation. And that's what gender is. So sex is not a determinant of gender, right? Gender is your self-presentation in terms of certain human patterns, certain human properties, of usually in terms of femininity and masculinity. And the traditional understanding is there is no real distinction, right? What they are calling gender are simply the social manifestations and concomitants of sex, of being either male or female. But her distinction is very important. It comes out as a theoretical presupposition of her feminism. And so she's also a very good writer. I mean, you think about these.
Oh, she's very good. There's a wonderful interview. You can see it. I saw it on YouTube a few months ago. It's in French, but with English subtitles. She's been interviewed by this fairly fawning young kind of Parisian journalist, where she explains all this, but she does it in a way that, you know, very, very impressive in terms of her eloquence, her charisma. Quite seductive again, if you're kind of naive enough to just buy into this whole philosophy. But yeah, again, she was Sartre's equal in many ways. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, very, very much so. So if the publication, this is from the article again, if the publication in 1990 of Judith Butler's Gender Trouble, which we're going to get to next, marks the watershed moment for the gender fluidity movement that dumbfounded readers in the first decades of the 21st century, Sartre's consort, partner, Simone de Beauvoir's pivotal 1949 work, The Second Sex, was its seed. So this is all in this very tumultuous, immediate post-war period where everyone's kind of, what's just happened? I mean, what's come of human nature, the terrible crimes that have been perpetuated, the names of these ideologies and so on. And it's a time where people are very, very susceptible to something radical and new, especially if it has this kind of ethical coloring. But in any case, Sartre's concept, Simone de Beauvoir's pivotal work, The Second Sex, was its seed. So it's the seed of all of this transgender. It doesn't explicitly develop it, but there's a very clearly traceable element. So in the imposition of coercive liberalism on the manipulated individual in the creation of a tyrannical majority, the repudiation of human nature and the complementarity of the sexes is a key article of faith. So it's very important to believe that there's no human nature and that there's no real complementarity between the sexes. That's all oppression. That's all power interest. That's all false projection. So the Beauvoir's famous opening lines are a telling summation of her project. Again, it's you know, almost akin to what we saw from Marx. It's very satirical. It's very she is really mocking these traditional institutions. Is femininity secreted by the ovaries? Is it enshrined in a Platonic heaven? Again, what we just saw from Sartre in terms of, you know, there's no real human nature because there's no God to have a concept of it. Is a frilly petticoat enough to bring it down to earth? Although some women zealously strive to embody it, the model has never been patented. It is typically described in a vague and shimmering terms borrowed from a clairvoyant's vocabulary. So it's this sense, this implication that people who are talking about real essences, they don't have epistemological humility. They think they're clairvoyant somehow. They know everything. They can penetrate into the real essences of things. And this is depicted here as very implausible. In St. Thomas's time, it was an essence defined with as much certainty as the sedative quality of a poppy. But conceptualism has lost ground. Biological and social sciences says that it's the invocation of the authority of modernity. The reader has no idea. I mean, in most cases, won't have any idea about the details, but they'll go along with it. So it's a new form of authority. The biological and social sciences no longer believe there are immutably determined entities that define given characteristics, like those of the woman, the Jew, or the black. It's probably appealed to the emotions there to say the Jew or the black. Science considers characteristics as secondary reactions to a situation. So again, it's this inversion. Reality is no longer the instantiation of timeless principles, but rather it is the process itself. And then we construct the, you know, the timeless interpretation, the fixed interpretation as a free creative act on the basis of what we observe. If there is no such thing as femininity today, it is because there never was. Does the word woman then have no content? It is what advocates of Enlightenment philosophy, rationalism, or nominalism vigorously assert. Women are, amongst human beings, merely those who are arbitrarily designated by the word woman.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's quite packs a punch. I mean, she's
even Richard Dawkins, the arch atheist, but nevertheless professor of science in some way, you know, is doing the rounds on YouTube and some other platforms these days, asserting the biological realities of gender. I mean, he's now gone from, you know, from being this risque anti-establishment, anti-religious figure, now actually upholding the verities of biological fact that our species comes in two binaries, male and female. So what she's saying here, biological social science no longer believe there are mutable determined entities. That may be true of social sciences, but it ain't true of biology.
Yeah, I'd fully agree with you. Although I would have to say that I find ultimately that kind of, you know, hard-headed common sense rationalism, which really has nothing to do with rationalism, of people like Dawkins, is actually ultimately less consistent than, let's say, Sartre and Beauvoir. Why? Because Dawkins does have a degree of metaphysical naivety when he says such things.
True.
Because the fact is, built upon the undoubted physical substratum of gender in the sense of sex in the sense of gender, there are the, what you'd say in Arabic, the ma'anawi, there are the intelligible dimensions, the fact that femininity is not really construable as a biological entity. Right. It's a ma'anawi entity. It's an intelligible entity.
Right. Yeah.
And the thing is, someone like Dawkins has no account of that whatsoever.
He's got a crude materialist understanding of this, and you have a much more nuanced metaphysical understanding. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, I think for all his pretty evident failings, Sartre at least does understand that.
Hmm.
He understands what he's doing.
Oh, yes, he does. Now, this is very true. Yeah. Just like Nietzsche, I mean, they knew exactly what they were doing. Whereas other people, I mean, I mentioned George Eliot, Marianne Evans. She carried on living a quasi-Christian life and speaking Christian morality in her novels, even though in her heart she believed. And she was criticized by Nietzsche by name for not working through the implications of her atheism in the way he had done and the way that Sartre came to do as well. So you can be someone who doesn't really wrestle through philosophically, like Marianne Evans is accused of not doing, but Sartre and Nietzsche did. And that's why they're so this is almost heroic. I say almost because they're not really heroes at all, but there's almost something heroic about their fearless consequentialism. We'll go to the pit with our views if necessary. And that's probably where they are.
Sadly, it's difficult to disagree with you. So, of course, de Beauvoir is at pains to point out that woman does exist. She exists as a social construct. She does exist, it's just as a social construct. As she tells us, one is, now this is a very famous statement of hers, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. Now you can see how there are barely any steps left now to where we're to the present day. One is not born, but rather becomes a woman. With this thought, we encounter the ne plus ultra of so-called self-determining individual freedom, which has been this fixation, really, of post-Enlightenment Western thought from Kant onwards. And it's advanced contemporary reading. Although one is surely an individual of a nature in the sense of essence, but not to be constrained even by one's nature. Because the nature is not real. You know, it's the totality of social relations or whatever formulation one chooses. It must not be thought that in this process of self-creation, however, one escapes the web of social construction and somehow penetrates into reality. It doesn't mean you're getting at reality, no. Instead, once the last most persistent and unyielding essences, pseudo-essences, falsely reified, falsely concretized essences, are finally banished, such as gender nature and human nature, all become social construct. Butler, the doyen of contemporary gender fluidism, goes much further than de Beauvoir. So we finally got there. Employing de Beauvoir's distinction between sex and gender, Butler holds that it is not merely gender that is a social construct, but sex itself. Right? And that's why what we consider to be self-mutilation, that sacred transmogrification, is actually possible and it's real. So, I thought we were getting to Butler. Sorry. That's in the way.
He's always getting in the way, Foucault.
Yeah, he is nowadays, I'm afraid. He's everywhere, absolutely everywhere. So we're going to have to deal with this. My least favorite part of it. But anyway, get to Michel Foucault. So this is from the last chapter of his very famous History of Sexuality. This is the last chapter of his first volume. And this is really his flagship idea, his pivotal contribution to this whole downward spiral. And it's usually not easy to pinpoint. And what was Foucault actually saying? What was his actual contribution? Mm. It just seems this kind of very highfalutin, very kind of conditional sophistication for sophistication's sake. But it is possible to glean a real, very, very distinct contribution to the development of gender fluidism theory. And so he says, it is precisely this idea of sex in itself, which he doesn't accept at all, by the way, that we cannot accept without examination. He thinks it's a fiction. He's about to say it's a fiction. Is sex, and this is in the sense of gender, of course, is sex really the anchorage point that supports the manifestations of sexuality? Or is it not rather a complex idea that was formed inside the deployment of sexuality? And we alluded to this earlier. This is his key idea. And again, it's the same Hegelian Marxist inversion. Practice and process are primary. Those are what are real. We construct fixed realities out of them, but they're not what's real. Mm-hmm. So what's real is the deployment of sexuality, which is fundamentally in itself neutral. It's arbitrary. It doesn't presuppose sexes. It actually creates sexes, in the sense of genders, with the help of the exercise of power interests, right, of the state, of whatever, who wants, you know, to create this idea of, you know, this, what they would consider to be this very crude, you know, merely traditional idea of the family, where there's, you know, the monogamous, man and wife who stay together forever and raise a family, and this is the natural state of affairs, and so on. That's actually for him a false reification, which is the result, as implausible as it sounds, which it actually, I think, even sounds very, very implausible, that it's purely that, even if we were, for the sake of argument, purely to admit that it was partially due to power interest. But you know, the state, you know, over thousands of years, the powers that be falsely reify these concepts because they want to encourage certain forms of sexual relationship to further their own interests. So, but he says what's real is the deployment of sexuality. That's just the practice of sexuality, people's proclivities, their sexual practice, which in itself is fundamentally neutral and arbitrary. We think it presupposes the opposite genders, but for him it doesn't. I mean, it's important.
I know this is just kind of the genetic fallacy, but I can't help but think that he himself, Foucault, was, as he would put it, a gay man who was known to frequent the certain places in San Francisco, which transmitted HIV, and he died of AIDS. I mean, yeah. I mention all this not to blacken his name or something, but this kind of chaotic, anonymous, promiscuous, detached, you know, his lifestyle, his very mode of living complements in the sense of, you know, fits together with this kind of outlook. And I don't, what I'm trying to say in mentioning this is that's not a coincidence for me. These two reflect each other in some way. His chaotic lifestyle, which led to his demise, is reflected in some way in his theory, and vice versa. There's a relationship between them. And to detach the man from his work, I think, is artificial.
Absolutely, I agree with you. And I think that it's you know, if one finds out certain facts about Foucault's later life, and I wouldn't want to darken our discussion by going into them, but it's a mystery that he hasn't been prima facie, it's a mystery that he hasn't been cancelled.
Well, we can say, because it's public knowledge, that he had a taste for, shall we put it, young, very young males.
Exactly.
This is known. And why hasn't he been cancelled is a very good question.
It's a very good question. He's another one of these people who are too big to cancel. So much rests upon him. Like Darwin, who was a raging racist, so was Kant.
Yes, the ascent of man. Is it the descent or the ascent? I can never quite remember which way around it is.
Yeah.
The descent of man, which I've got and read, contains, you know, stuff that Hitler would have quite easily incorporated in Mein Kampf if he bothered.
Well, he did, actually, yeah.
Oh, he did. It shows how badly aware I am of Mein Kampf. But my point is that Darwin hasn't been cancelled, and yet he was an outrageous racist. If you got to read his stuff, it's quite extraordinary.
Well, he's uncancellable. It did actually come out recently. I know it was just suppressed because people can't, you know, it's back to this secular religion. It's really, there are certain individuals who are seen to, I mean, let's say they have, I mean, those things will be interpreted as kind of foibles. You know, he was just a man, he was a product of his time, and, you know, he can't be blamed for that because he's too big to cancel. We can't, you know, if we're to eliminate Darwin, then we don't have the whole basis of our modern worldview. And if we our materialist worldview, and if we eliminate Foucault, then all of the, you know, whether it's whatever it happens to be, whatever activists' cause, whatever woke cause it is today, but certainly this crowning instance of that deification of the self-determining will, which is the...
Although I agree with you, I think that there's a great irony in this, to dwell on Marx for a second. Marx wasn't just... Karl Marx, by the way, wasn't just that Darwin was a racist. Marx was as well, particularly about Jews. This is the irony, because he was Jewish.
Yeah.
You know, his father and grandfather's a rabbi, he wrote a book on the Jewish question, and he recycled the most anti-Semitic tropes imaginable in his own writings. He didn't have to do it. I mean, he was, you know, a refugee in London. No one was forcing him to write this stuff. Exactly. But he did. So he's eminently cancelable, I would have imagined, along with Darwin and along with Foucault. But hey, they're not being cancelled, which is odd. But anyway, you give me a reason.
In a way, it's odd, and in a way, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. No, you are right. Anyway,
wonderful. So next one. This is again from the final chapter of his very, very famous book, The History of Sexuality. Final chapter of the first volume. The notion of sex. The creation of this notion of sex in the sense of gender, as far as he's concerned, made it possible to group together in an artificial unity anatomical elements, biological functions, conduct, sensations and pleasures, and it enabled one to make use of this fictitious, and coming out and saying it's fictitious, this fictitious unity as a causal principle. So again, it's a critique of metaphysics, it's a critique of sex as gender as a metaphysical principle. which at the end, when we finally get past all of these people, these rather unfortunate people, that may Allah guide Judith Butler, because she's still alive. But we'll finally get to a short exposition of a more positive way of looking at this, which is gender in the Islamic tradition as a metaphysical principle.
Good.
So an omnipresent, meaning a secret to be discovered everywhere. Sex was thus able to function as a unique signifier and as a universal signified. And then another place, on the contrary, sex is the most speculative, most ideal, and most internal element in a deployment of sexuality organized by power, in its grip on bodies and their materiality, their forces, energies, sensations, and pleasures. So he wanted us to free us from these false restrictions so we could return to almost a state of nature, which is this arbitrary deployment of sexuality. And that's why he thought this was so early. Yeah.
And that, and what you've just highlighted there in green could almost be autobiographical in his experiences in certain places in San Francisco. You know, their bodies, their forces, energies, sensations, pleasures, brackets, I'm not going to say because it's a bit haram, but you know, there's almost, I think, Freud looking at this thinking, there's a subtext here about his life. It almost seems autobiographical. If you know a bit about Foucault's life, this is almost autobiography masquerading as theory.
That is the impression you get from reading him very, very strongly, that he's very, there's something very visceral, almost desperate, almost sexual about the way that he's writing.
I
was just about to say, you know, this goes back to what we saw towards the beginning of our discussion, which is that he predicted almost, and I think he's proven to be right. I mean, whether it's a self-fulfilling prophecy or not, I don't know, but he saw that if we could challenge the normativity of heterosexuality, that would ultimately lead to the disappearance of the notion of sex itself as a fixed essence type of thing. So that's just very interesting to bear in mind.
Yeah.
So we finally get to our last figure, Judith Butler.
Yes.
Yeah. Who I didn't realize when I was writing the article was probably physically about 200 meters away from me, because he not only lived in Berkeley, but in Berkeley Hills, which is exactly where I lived.
I saw a video of hers very recently at the University of Cambridge, hosted by the university with the sociology department banner behind her and another banner. The university loved her. And I'm thinking, this is Cambridge University promoting Judith Butler as if she's some kind of secular god.
Absolutely. And those are two very, very key centers. Cambridge is a very, very key center of this whole movement. And as is, of course, Berkeley. And then again, I mean, just to be clear, because I think it's Islamic akhlaq, you know, we have nothing against her as a person. I didn't really deliberately choose this, especially flattering photograph of her, where she looks like a kind of dark lord. In fact, my daughter came up to me while I was making this presentation. She said, "Oh, Daddy, that looks like Voldemort, but with his half of his face." Half of her face in the shadows.
Oh my goodness, man!
I've got nothing against this person. She's a human individual, as you know. We have nothing against people who identify as homosexual, as transgender, or anything.
He says a lesbian. She does identify as a lesbian, obviously.
Yeah, as a lesbian. This is not, and this is not some sort of, you know, fearful disclaimer. I'm not worried about any of that. I mean, for one thing, I suppose I have the luxury of living in Jordan, but it's just, I think, Islamic akhlaq, because the whole point is this, a real false reification, which is the false reification of the identity, as if sexual proclivity is the person. I don't look at Judith Butler and see her as some sort of demon. She's a human being, human being like us. And I ask that Allah guides her away from these beliefs, which are hurting her ultimately and hurting so many other people. In any case, as we have seen, Judith Butler is unpersuaded by such self-evidence. Having confirmed the distinction between sex and gender, she's not even prepared to acknowledge that we are born a particular sex. She tells us she's following Foucault and the self-proclaimed lesbian materialist Monique Wittig. I've read quite a lot of her works, and she was very highly influential again on Butler, when she says, "The demarcation of anatomical difference does not precede," imagine stating this, "does not precede the cultural interpretation of that difference." It doesn't precede it. but is itself, you know, a baby's born, right? You check to find out what gender it is, right? For her, that demarcation that you are positing there, using alien language, it doesn't precede the cultural interpretation of that difference. You think it does because that's just what's normal, but it doesn't in reality. But is it in itself an interpretive act laden with normative assumptions? I mean, this is the stuff that people are filling their heads with now. It's really worrying. That infants are divided into sexes at birth, which it points out, serves the social ends. Again, it's the social ends. It's the power interest, the social ends of reproduction. But they might just as well be differentiated on the basis of earlobe formation, or better still, not be differentiated on the basis of anatomy at all.
I mean, any normal person, and sort of, you know, this is a kind of a hearsay, would, if they understood what was just read there, would just see this as just insanity. I mean, it has nothing real about it at all. It's complete bonkers. To say that a child's male and female is not be differentiated on the basis of anatomy at all, the complete and utter irrelevance of anatomy in determining the gender of a child, it's just pure bonkers. I mean, there's no better way of putting it. And I'm flabbergasted that people take this seriously, and that it is taken very seriously.
Well, I think, you know, this is not anything conspiratorial. I think it's just really factual. This is a cult, right? Cults have their own internal logic. You know, postmodernism is a cult, and the whole woke thing is a cult as well. So they're not interested in objective truth because they've already a priori, ironically enough, they've already a priori excluded the idea of objective truth. They don't even accept the principle of non-contradiction or basic logical principles. And the reason I find that so evil is because they've themselves thrown away the key. You know, they can't get out of this now because... Yeah. Real logic, real principle is a way to save yourself, you know, to emerge from this by reasoning. Because there's no reasoning. This is the nature of sophistry, and this is sophistry. This is the height of sophistry. The nature of this sophistical reason is there's no way out of it. It's a circular, self-justifying argument. And that's why, with all due respect to those people, I'm not saying they're involved in a conspiracy, but I find those who are trying to advocate that we as Muslims should go down the path of, you know, coherent theories of truth and acquiescing in whatever new intellectual fashion happens to be around, it's just extremely dangerous, because we're actually going to shut off our own way out of this mess that so many others
know. What I like, just I hope you maybe going to be doing this in a second, but in your article, which is found in the current edition, of course, of the journal, at the very top of the page, this is your article, is a quote from actually God speaking, although it's an English translation, and the male is not as the female, Quran 3:36. And I actually it was interesting. I posted this on Twitter about a day or so ago, and many people said, and quite understandably, when they first read this verse in the Quran years ago, they thought, why is God stating the obvious? It's so axiomatic.
Yeah.
Why is God bothering to do this? But now they get it.
Yeah.
This is a timely word, an eternal word to our species at this moment, that there is, the male is not like the female. So that this word has been waiting, in a sense, in its obviousness, for all this time to suddenly make this impact. And we need to hear this word because it's rooted in transcendent metaphysical truth rather than the shifting processes of Hegelian logic. So there's a beautiful choice of quote there in your article.
Thank you. So as we've seen, Judith Butler is unpersuaded by such self-evidence. I've been talking about certain self-evident arguments for believing that gender is a real thing. Having confirmed the distinction between sex and gender, she's not even prepared for... Oh, I've read this entire slide. Gosh, we need to move on.
Sorry, I've been just distracting you. My apologies.
Sorry. There's so many slides. So to return to anatomy, on Butler's view, so this is a kind of refutation of what they're saying. The illusion of nature and that they're prepared to call it that is extraordinary, leads us to believe that our cognition of anatomical differences, in this case pertaining to the so-called genitals, they would say so-called genitals, is again absurd, entails awareness of an objective distinct reality with inherent necessary social implications. But in fact, quote again from her, what we believe to be a physical and direct perception is only a sophisticated mythic construction, an imaginary formation, which reinterprets physical features in themselves as neutral as any other, but marked by the social system through the network of relationships in which they are perceived. There is no nature in society. From a more traditional philosophical perspective, the very fact that historical unions of these imaginary formations, these mythic constructions, have occasioned the existence of each individual in the human race, including Butler and Foucault and all that lot, poses rather a problem to their being thus characterized, that is, as imaginary formations.
This is you being humorous, of course, Hassan, in a very dry English way. I think.
Yeah, sorry. or mythic constructions. This is because the principle that an existent thing cannot be caused by that which is non-existent. This is because of the principle that an existent thing cannot be caused by that which is non-existent.
Indeed.
One can only assume that the likes of Wittig and Butler believe that they exist, that human beings are real in that sense. Alas, for their theories, this means that these ubiquitous imaginary formations must not be imaginary after all.
Indeed.
The idea that there is some, this is a more general point, right, kind of summing up. The idea that there is some better, more fulfilling reality for the individual to achieve by freeing him or herself from the oppression of nature precisely traces its ideological motivation to a sustained attack on the traditional family, which was among the most vital linchpins for the original theoreticians of constructionism and thus of gender fluidism. So if we think back to the sequence that we saw over, going from heterosexual promiscuity to challenging the normativity of heterosexuality to actually denying sex in the sense of gender, there's another factor which is very much related to all of that, of this, and is in a sense becomes more and more advanced, and the family deteriorates more and more as these stages unfold, which is the attack on the traditional family. And it's so important for us as Muslims today to prioritize the family, to uphold the family, regardless of our own status. I mean, there are so many single Muslims today and people in different situations, and of course this is an ideal which we all recognize, but the family is that ship that will bear us across these stormy waters, and it's so important. And it's so important for the other side, I mean, sorry to put into these those terms, but it's so important for the other side to denigrate the notion of the traditional notion of family for reasons that we'll see. So the idea that there is some better, more fulfilling reality of the individual to achieve by freeing him or herself from the oppression of nature traces its motivation to a sustained attack on the traditional family, which was among the most vital linchpins for the original theoreticians of constructionism and thus of gender fluidism. This arose most fundamentally from the key progenitor of gender anti-realism, which can be identified in the disavowal of the notion that gender roles possess any rooting in gender nature. So another very important step on the way, for example, when it comes to the distinction between sex and gender specifically, which is de Beauvoir's very, very key contribution, is this disavowal of the notion that gender roles possess any rooting in gender nature or gender, sex in the sense of gender nature. So, of course, if, as Marx taught, human nature is just the totality of social relations, it in no way determines those social relations because it's not there to determine them, because that nature does not exist prior to those relations. On the contrary, social relations are ripe. Those social relations which create human nature are ripe for rearrangement, reconfiguration, redefinition, reinvention, indeed permanent revolution. Right. And once this takes place, human nature itself will ever change. So for Friedrich Engels, who is, of course, you know, his great intellectual, Marx's great intellectual collaborator and friend for all of those years, and his main financier.
I was going to say, because ironically, Friedrich Engels owned factories in Manchester. He was actually a capitalist himself.
Right.
He even though he was a Marxist, he was actually a capitalist and financed Marx basically for his entire life because he was hopeless at making, as his wife complained, Marx's wife complained, you're very good at writing about capital, but you never be able to produce any.
I was about to say that, yeah.
Oh, sorry, I'm stealing your lines.
No, but that's very, I'm glad that you said it. We're very much on the same page. Absolutely. That's he lived in a state of constant chaos and penury.
Yes.
Marx, which is extraordinary for someone of his stature and influence and intelligence. Yes. So for Frederick Engels, who 1884, The Origin of the Family, was published a year after Marx's death, the first class struggle was that between man and wife in the married state. And you this is not some, kind of distant theory. This is, it's amazing how triumphant Engels' view has been and how it has reshaped societies, including, basic fundamental assumptions, girl power and all of this stuff. It really comes out of this fundamental philosophy, the idea that there are no, real differences between women and men and women, just as they rather disgustingly say, different equipment. That's it. And so, women should do exactly the same jobs as men. Not the nasty menial ones, of course, like whatever.
Roadkeepers or
road builders. But it's this completely unreflective assumption, or in most cases, quite unreflective assumption, and the set of assumptions which come out of this philosophy. In any case, so the first class struggle was that between man and wife in the married state, and the first class oppression, that of the female sex by the male. Men stood to women in this relation as the bourgeoisie to the proletariat. The modern family is founded on what he calls the open or concealed domestic slavery of the wife, who is forced into marriage because of the economic dependence of unmarried women on men, which is why, quote, the first condition for the liberation of the wife is to bring the whole female sex back into public industry, and that in turn demands the abolition of the monogamous family as the economic unit of society. Since in the proposed communist society, all children will be raised by the whole of society, including children born out of wedlock, moral and economic anxiety about the consequences of fornication, which is, of course, very, very strong in Victorian Britain, will no longer prevent a girl from giving herself completely to the man she loves, which is, of course, a very naive appeal to the emotions. Engels eagerly suggests that this would in turn bring about the gradual growth of unconstrained sexual intercourse, which, of course, it did. And that concludes that rather dismal history, I'm afraid. So I don't know if you'd like to come in on anything before we go to our final section.
I've already said too much, and I'm very much looking forward from this very dark presentation to hearing something much more positive. I don't mean in terms of your own. I mean in terms of the content is inherently disturbing.
Absolutely.
Very disturbing indeed.
Absolutely.
You clearly trace the genealogy of many of these ideas. It was really, really important to understand this, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Alhamdulillah. So to our final section, and we talked about the inversion. So what's the asl? What is, in some sense, the metaphysically natural way of looking at this? So Islam and gender as metaphysical principle. Now, this was mostly about the genealogy of transgender theory or gender fluidism or whatever we want to call it. And I'm not going to go into the Islamic principles very exhaustively, but a brief overview, just so as you say, we can have a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. So this is actually the very beginning of the article, but man is the meeting place of the angelic and the animal realms. This is the human essence. So we span the worlds. We have this extraordinary, unique nature. We are, in a way, the barzakh or isthmus between the different worlds. The reason we can be the khalifa or steward of the world is because there's something of all of the worlds within us. In some sense, we span the world. We're kind of extended over the world in some strange way as the meeting place of the angelic, which is kind of the spiritual, the intellectual, dimension, the animal, which is very clear. I mean, you know, the definition of animal in our tradition is that it's a jism nami yataharak bil irada, right? Or jism nami hassas in a extended definition, yataharak bil irada. It's very, very simple. The question, are we animals, in that sense, can easily be answered. Because an animal is a jism nami, it's a growing body, right, which is sensitive, it can sense physically, yet a harak bil irada, that can move, that can set itself in motion by free volition, by free will. That's what an animal is. So when we say, you know, hayawan natik, rational animal, is the definition, albeit Aristotelian definition, possibly not the ultimately best definition. I don't think it is, but it's valid for its own purposes. What we mean is that, you know, man is it hayawan natik, he's a jism nami hasas mutaharrik bil irada, who's also mutafakkir bil quwwa, which is the meaning of natik, who can engage in reflection, in thought, in abstract thought, and so that, in a way, that definition brings together an aspect, which is not at all exhaustive, but of our status as the meeting place of the angelic and the animal. So this is the human essence. So we've just seen all of these rejections of human essences. As some of the greatest philosophers of the Islamic tradition have taught us, from Raghib al-Isfahani and al-Ghazali to Shah Waliullah. Now, from the revealed law as supported by traditional philosophical ethics, we know that we do not win unto the intrinsic dignity of the actualized human essence through the sheer fact of our possession of this unique composite nature, but rather, this is the whole, you know, Allah Ta'ala says in the Quran, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, Tabarak alladhi khalaq al-mauta wal-hayata liyabluwakum, sorry, Tabarak alladhi biyadihi al-mulku wa huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir, alladhi khalaq al-mauta wal-hayata liyabluwakum, ayyukum ahsanu amala, right? God created death and life in order to test you, which of you is best in action. This arena is a test. That's its essence. That's what it is. People wonder, well, why is it so difficult? A problem of evil? No, it's supposed to be like this. This is the essence of human embodiment in the world, finite embodiment. It is a test. That's its very nature. That's why we're here. It's fundamentally, most fundamentally, is a test. And so it's not just, you know, we don't kind of get off scot-free just because the meeting place of the angelic and the animal. In fact, that puts us in a very different situation, because if you have a composite nature, you are then charged with ordering it. You have the free will then to order it. Are you going to allow the animal to dominate or the angelic to dominate? It's not that one or the other is, but it's not the animal becomes bad if it's dominated. It's just that that's its proper place in respect to the angelic. It's subordinate to the angelic. It's still good in itself. It has its own role, but it is subordinate to the angelic. It can't dominate the angelic. One can't have impulse and instinct, which are not bad in themselves, but they're dominating reason and intellect. That's the wrong way around. So it's not in the sheer fact of our possession of this nature, but rather by correctly ordering the various aspects of our nature through the appropriate exercise of our self-determining individual free will. And yet we are not static, disassociated, disembodied beings peering out at the world from ivory cloisters. To be a human is to be one or the other of two intrinsically, mutually completing agents of a generative love that is inescapably and intrinsically binary. In the experience of this most primeval fact of human embodiment, that's why we're all here, namely that every human being instantiates one and only one amongst two genders, an experience which each of us has simply in virtue of being human, we find that we represent instantiations of intrinsically dual metaphysical principles of generation embedded in the very structure of being. They can't be constructed or projected, because they're actually, ironically, transhuman. they transcend the instantiated, embodied, immanent human state. Indeed, each human being, I don't mind using a bit of Heideggerian language, there's two Heideggerian terms I love, which is thrownness and being a shepherd of being. I think those are both absolutely fantastic.
It's a design, I'm going to pronounce it properly. Design?
I think it's design.
Dasein, sorry, to be through, well, the idea, well, anyway, that's a different subject, but yeah.
Absolutely. So, indeed, each human being is thrown into one of these two roles. We do not choose to be a man or a woman. We're thrown into that role. We find that we're a man or a woman. And there is something about that findingness, just to make up my own Heideggerian term, life, there's something about that experience which was intended by God. It's not something that should be played with, although I'm not happy with this. No, God intended you to be a man, or he intended you to be a woman. You find that you're a man or a woman. And that was intended by God. That's your, I don't mean it's your place, because one is not better than the other, but that is your role. That is your complementary role, and one has to embrace it. So we're thrown into the role, but we do not choose to be a man or a woman. A further aspect of achieving human dignity thus lies in accepting God's choice and fulfilling with beautiful and beautifying excellence, ihsan. Hasan means beautiful. Ihsan is the form for causative, which means to do the beautiful.
So that's beautiful, Spiker, indeed.
Oh, thank you. It's good and beautiful. I'm the good and beautiful. I'm very humble.
You're good and beautiful. Okay.
So the role, so it's to fulfill with that beautifying and that beautiful and beautifying excellence, that beautiful, wonderful Islamic term, ihsan, the role that we have been allotted precisely in having been thus created, male or female. The liberating
beautiful, truth. Beautiful, by the way. Beautiful.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Too kind. So this is then right at the end of the book, the liberating article, the liberating truth offered by the tools of the Islamic tradition is that gender arises from both. I think this is a very strong way to counteract this line of thought. It arises from both our animal nature and our angelic nature. Because as we were saying, it does have a physical dimension and an intelligible dimension. In the sense, you know, intelligible in the sense of object of the mind. You know, femininity and masculinity, they're really objects of the mind. There's nothing, you can't really find an empirical property that they answer to, right? So in a way, that's why I was saying that, you know, the Sartres of the world are more consistent than Dawkins ultimately, despite he has this, yeah, I'm just a common sense, hard-headed, rational person who believes in science. But at the end of the day, there is a lot of interpretation in science, and there's a lot of interpretation in our experience of our daily world, which is not physical and not empirical, can't be construed in any way as physical. But against the postmodernists and this whole stream of thought, we contend that the fact that it is intelligible, it's not physical, it's the object of the mind, doesn't entail its subjectivity. It can be mental in some way and be objective. And that really is the whole point of my book, Things As They Are. And so, you know, if someone wanted to substantiate that further, I'd direct them there. But
just a quick commercial break then.
Commercial
break. I mean, that's the book you're just referring to. So do get a copy of that. It's there you are. It's available on Amazon if that is your chosen vendor. I'm saying you should go to Amazon, but anyway, you can get it from there.
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Got to have our commercial breaks. I notice you don't have product placements like Russell Brand does yet. So,
well, I'm not Russell Brand. So no, he's
very humorous. So it's not so jarring. In any case, so the liberating truth is that gender arises from both our animal nature and our angelic nature. Yes, there is an intelligible nature. Yes, it's just going to be moralizing. It's just going to be the conservative doing everything that the liberal does just a bit later. If we don't recognize, yes, there is a, you know, what's called in Islamic philosophy a shubha. There's a doubt. That it's not just stupid that people have started thinking this way. There is this mystery about the fact that gender not only has this anatomical basis, but there is also this intelligible dimension, these properties of femininity and masculinity, which can't really be construed as empirical. They may have an empirical basis, or even that's kind of doubtful in a direct sense, but they may have, they certainly have an ontological substratum, we would say, but there's certainly a distinction between these two aspects of gender. It's just that we would say that in reality, they are an inexpugnable unity. One can't separate one from the other in reality.
Inexpugnable. I love that word, inexpugnable. I'm going to have to start using that word. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I found that in a thesaurus for purposes of this book. I'm not sure if I've used it. It is a rather lovely one. I use thesauruses extensively. Can't live without them. So I wish that I was just a genius who could churn out poetry without using one. But in any case, so it arises from both our animal nature and our angelic nature. Indeed, the animal nature is informed by the angelic nature. So, you know, sex exists in the sense of gender, exists in the animal world, but it's not the same as human gender. The generative love that arises from the union of the two gender principles is not merely the production of children, self-evidently sublime and momentous as that is, but the cultivation of the world through the actualization of complementary attributes that can only obtain via the intelligible rather than merely physical union of the gender principles, the receptive, affective, nurturing, compassionate, beautiful feminine, a matrix of predominant but not exclusive, which is always the immediate objection.
I like this. You always say, but not exclusive, twice. You did that in reference to the feminine and also into the masculine. I like that because you're not thereby, because there is a certain sense of a spectrum here rather than two discrete monolithic male female entities. So you do have a nuance there, which I really like. I just wanted to say that.
Well, thank you. And it's also, you know, we respect and you know, people are on that spectrum, and there are women who, with all respect, we have slightly more masculine properties than
Judith Butler, for example.
Yeah, for example, than other women. And there are men who have slightly more feminine properties, perhaps, but they are subject to this regulation by an ultimate feminine principle and an ultimate masculine principle. But it's not to say that everyone has to be exactly the stereotype of masculinity or femininity.
Yeah.
On the other hand, restoring masculinity and femininity is of the greatest moment and importance. Their fundamental importance and their reality for the very purpose that I'm trying to explain at the moment. And then the providing, active, protecting, majestic masculine, a matrix of predominant but not exclusive attributes that supervenes on the biologically male. That is, the exigencies of human nature entail that human gender comprise dimensions of depth simply not shared by mere animal gender, and which are consequences of the unique potential possessed by human beings to become the realized vicegerents and stewards of the world. So these, of course, allusion to many, many different verses in the Quran, but the istikhlaf of mankind, that we, Allah Ta'ala, appoints us, Jalla Jalaluhu, as the vicegerents of the world, his stewards, who are responsible for the cultivation of the world, for looking after the world. Many, many such verses. Inna aradna al-amanata ala samawati wal-ard fa'abayna an yahmilnaha wa ashfaqna minha wa hamalaha al-insan. We offered the trust, which is the khilafah, which is the stewardship, the vicegerency, to the heavens and the earth.
Yes,
extraordinary. I think I missed out Stafrullah wal Jibal and the mountains. For abayna an yahmilnaha, and they shrank from bearing them, and they were afraid of it. They were afraid it was such a weighty vocation, a weighty charge.
Mm.
And man took it on. Muhammad al Sun, right? It was man who. So, so this is what we're talking about here. So, it's unique consequence of the unique potential possessed by human beings to become the realized vicegerents and stewards of the world, the complementary of attributes that can only obtain by means of the union of mutually completing genders presupposes humankind's unique nature as the meeting place of the angelic, the animal. Why? It arises from our unique status as stewards of the earth, in which the balance and harmony we seek to effect must first be realized through the achievement of equilibrium between opposite attributes. This principle derived from the, I mean, in a way, it's because the world, before getting into any highfalutin metaphysical stuff, it's just because the world contains lots of opposite attributes, which are, you know, fighting one another, essentially, which are at least in opposition to one another. And, you know, we need to set the world in order, in balance and harmony. And that means balancing these opposite attributes in the proper equilibrium, proper harmony. It must be obtained through the achievement of equilibrium between opposite attributes. This principle, derived from the advanced metaphysical tradition of Islam, comes to the fore in one of the many later commentaries in the 14th century Muslim theologian Adil al-Iji's Ethics. So this is a very important work of philosophical ethics. There was a myth, which I hope has been exploded by now, that the Ash'ari normative Sunni Ash'ari Maturidi tradition didn't engage in philosophical ethics because they had the Sharia, and that meant that they didn't engage in philosophical ethics. But actually, they did very, very much into the latter centuries, very much in the Ottoman world particularly. There are many, many commentaries on E.G.'s work and Tulsi's work and many other works of philosophical ethics, and they complement one another, the Sharia and philosophical ethics. I mean, that's maybe a discussion for another time, but in any case, so this is one of those works. So this is Alaaddin al-Khazaruni, I believe. The wisdom underlying man having been brought into existence, man who is the encapsulation of all of the worlds, is that he might fulfill the divine vicegerency, as is clearly expressed by the tenor of the noble verse, I'm appointing on earth a vicegerent, the famous verses in Surah Al-Baqarah, Inni ja'ilun fil ardi khalifa, and is moreover the import of the one we just recited. We offered the trust unto the heavens and the earth and the mountains, and they shrank from bearing it, and they were afraid of it, but man carried it. Man's entitlement to the vicegerency is due to the perfect receptivity of his nature to opposite attributes, such that he is able to be a locus of manifestation, madhar. This is theophanic. There's nothing pantheistic about it. He doesn't become God, but he mirrors God's attributes of the opposite divine names and accomplish the habitation, cultivation, and construction of both the outward and spiritual worlds. So this is the stewardship, is to accomplish the habitation, cultivation, construction of both the outward and spiritual worlds. This is the final section of the both the article and the article, but things as they were, which someone at Rena Vartio was very witty, I think, in having a play on the title of my book, Things as They Are, Things as They Were. I didn't put that in, but I like it. So let us return to the healing and liberating truth offered by the tools of our tradition, for gender is merely the instantiation in the corporeal world. So again, this is the antidote to all of that madness that we were exploring. Gender is mere, what is gender then? It's merely the instantiation in the corporeal world of the very principle of complementarity. Why is there this thing called, you know, this is the metaphysical way of thinking, that, you know, we don't take anything for granted. So there is such a thing as complementarity in the world. Why? What is that fundamentally? It's a principle. It's not a empirical principle, really. It's not an empirical, not principle. It's not really an empirical phenomenon. There's nonetheless something which is very, very, very much part and parcel of our understanding of the world, the intelligibility of the world, the knowability of the world, just the world making sense. We see it in terms of these abstract concepts like complementarity. So it is the very principle of complementarity and generative union. Now, there are lots of different types of generative union, and, you know, various great thinkers in our tradition speak about this, that there are these, I mean, even the first two premises of a syllogism have been likened to gender principles, because they, as it were, marry one another and they produce the conclusion. literally.
I heard that. Oh, yes, indeed.
Yeah, you'll find that in the Futuhat al-Makkiyah and other books. According
even Hegel's thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
it is similar in a way, but I think
sorry to bring his name back into this.
In other ways, very, very much not similar. But yes, according to certain highly influential accounts of the metaphysics of creation, God, in his absolute wisdom and freedom, ordained that the sublunary world should presuppose in its emergence. Right. By the way, this is not Aqidah. It doesn't, people get very worried about this nowadays. I don't think they did in the past, but it's understandable. This is not Aqidah. This is a metaphysical exploration of revelation, reflecting upon the implications of certain passages in scripture, aided by pure rational investigation. And some of our metaphysicians have come up with this. Yeah. But it's within the normative tradition, but it doesn't make it aqidah. So just to give that disclaimer, it's not like, oh, I haven't heard of that. Do I have to believe that? Now I have to get worried and go and ask a sheikh or something. You don't. Just stick to your aqidah. That's the wonderful thing about aqidah. You just learn it and you stick to it. That's it. You don't waver from it. That's why it's you get statements of creed. And of course, that doesn't mean blindly following it or blind faith in it. We should try to understand it as best as possible. But it saves us from having to worry. If you're reading Sartre, it's like, oh, am I being hurt just by reading this? In reality, no, if you have your aqidah down very, very clearly and you're very strong in it, you don't have to worry about anything. Anything which conflicts with it, just reject and that's it. And this doesn't conflict with it. So according to certain highly influential accounts of the metaphysics of creation, God in his absolute wisdom and freedom ordained that the sublunary world, our world, should presuppose in its emergence the generative union. So these are transcendent, as it were, gender principles, but they're not human gender, of the supreme created active principle. So gender becomes the principle of activity and the principle of affectivity. The supreme pen or first intellect and the supreme created affective principle, the preserved tablet, Allah al-Mahfuz, which is in the Quran. So the supreme pen or first intellect, you'll find in numerous hadith reports of varying degrees of authenticity. And the preserved tablet you actually find in the Quran, Allah al-Mahfuz. The original gender principle, so as it were, the supreme pen, which is the ultimate principle of intelligibility, which has all of the universals, all of the essences, it writes upon, as it were, the universal soul, which doesn't just contain the universals, but it contains all of the particulars as well. All of the particular instantiations obtain figuratively, the supreme pen or first intellect writes upon the preserved tablet or universal soul. So scriptural language, Quran, hadith language is supreme pen and preserved tablet. The philosophical language in a philosophical tradition is first intellect and universal soul. The original gender principles which manifest throughout the metaphysical hierarchy of being. The love epitomized by these productive unions, what are called the metaphysical nikahat. So nikah is marriage, and it's also the act of intercourse in Arabic. The nikahat in these traditions is also used as a metaphysical principle. There are the metaphysical nikahat, marriages, literally, constitutes the very exemplar for the physical intelligible generation that result from the marriage of the corresponding principles of mutually completing complementarity in our world. Namely, the union and marriage of man and woman. The cultivation of complementary properties, without which equilibrium and harmony cannot obtain in this world, presupposes the harmonious relationship between the sexes embodying their traditional gender roles. A man must maintain and protect his family. This is the final slide. That is, proved to be the providing, active, protecting, majestic qawwam. There's the famous verse in the Quran, Ar-rijalu qawwamun ala nisa. So the qawwam is he who safeguards, maintains, and gives support. So that verse is translated something like, men are those that safeguard, maintain, and give support to women. The principle of affection, infial, exemplified by the preserved tablet in that understanding, or universal soul, requires that this distinctively male role be fulfilled by a complementary mode of human existence. The male active principle can only set in motion, but not himself fulfill, the giving and nurturing of life. Without getting too graphic, the male sets that in motion, but he doesn't. He can't in himself fulfill the nurturing of life, which is presupposed by the giving of life. He must seek required by the giving of life. He must seek companionship with the complementary female mode of existence, paradigmatically, although not solely receptive, affective, nurturing, compassionate, beautiful. Asking a woman to fulfill her role in the manner of a man who fulfills his, or the reverse, simply impairs the potential complementarity that is intrinsic to all human life and that every human stands in need of. Harmony is diminished thereby. The balance is broken. Ahmed Paul Keeler's language.
Mm.
The brilliant Ahmed Paul Keeler.
Also from Cambridge, a senior fellow.
Also from Cambridge. Now, the wisdom underlying the emergence of the genders was only the pursuit of intimate love. This is a quote from Muhyiddin Ibn Arabi from the Futuhat al-Makkiyah. The wisdom underlying the emergence of the genders was only the pursuit of intimate love in a parallel being of the same kind, such that in the world of bodies, through this natural fusion, the perfect human being, al-insan al-kamil, might exist in the form that God intended, resembling the supreme pen and the preserved tablet. It's a very interesting quote. And the Futuhat is full for want of a better word, not the right word, but theorizing and theoretical foundations for this metaphysical rooting of gender. Gender, then, is merely the instantiation in the bodily world of the metaphysical principles of complementarity and generative union that permeate all of God's creation. Such unions are responsible for the unfolding of the degrees of being, the cultivation of the world, and the stewardship of the cosmos, in which our uniquely human perfection, worth, and dignity really lie. The very being and integrity of the world are contingent on the actualized complementarity of the genders, which are far from fluid or dispensable. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Muhammad. Thank you so much for bearing with me, Paul.
I prolonged it, but I have linked to this article, your article, in the description below, and also the journal where it's from. The Journal of the Cinecolo Renovatio. This is the current edition with some other amazing articles as well.
It's a beautiful thing to have, people. I don't mind plugging this because I really believe in it. I think it's fantastic. I've never seen any journal which is so beautifully produced. True. Production values are really extraordinary. It's all in full colour and beautiful paper, and it's just a lovely thing to have.
Yes, it is. Yes, that's very true. It's itself a work of art. So that's where the article is to be found. As I've already mentioned, Hassan has already, that's his most recent book, Hierarchy and Freedom, which I do recommend, as I do all your works, actually. That's more on Kant, which is slightly more specialized. This is even more specialized, but also excellent as well. Do read Hassan's work. And when is your, you say it's forthcoming, your book on transgenderism. Do we have any idea when it might be published? Or
I was thinking that it was going to be the end of October, but I realized that's not really going to be possible. So I'd say sometime early in the new year, inshallah.
Right. Good. Well, I'm saying look forward to that. And thank you very much indeed for your exposition of this extraordinarily troubling subject. But the solutions are there if we were but to lay our hands on them. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's already been provided for us. We just need to recognize its wisdom and efficacy, its God-given nature, for things to be well again. Do you have any concluding words, Hassan, before we conclude?
I think I've said more than enough, and I just wanted to thank you for bearing with me. Allah bless you for all of the magnificent work that you're doing. And I know there's so many people who would echo that. And I think it's wonderful. You're really galvanizing the Muslim community and providing us something we've never had. I mean, it's really, forgive me for gushing here, but you can see it. It really is an extraordinary resource now. For me personally, I mean, I'm always thinking, when am I going to have time to explore this, you know, Ali Atai's latest thing, whatever it happens.
Yes, indeed.
I never do have time to do it, but I'm just happy it's there, so.
Yes, yeah, I know. It's an extraordinary privilege to host these amazing people such as yourself and Ali Atai and many others and to provide this resource for the Ummah. So it's a great privilege to be part of this as well. So thank you very much, Hassan, in Jordan. And it's goodbye from me in London. Till next time.
Salam.